the late 60s of the Iran construction industry, Iran had a very few trained, skilled workers, especially in the building industry. What we decided to do was to bring a new technology to Iran that would essentially be very skilled labor. It would not need a lot of skilled labor. What we did was to import from Holland a new technology that was called precast concrete technology. And it was a very specialized system that I had used in the United States called shock beton. I, in fact, helped negotiate to bring this factory to Iran. It was set up and it produced many, many nice, wonderful buildings, including the Saman Towers. Since Iran is in an earthquake zone, whenever you're building a tall building, you have to be extremely careful to have earthquake resistant design. So we actually have done in Iran one of the most innovative new constructions that had ever been done in the 60s, which was to do a precast concrete tower that was built in an earthquake zone. And at this precast tower, all of the walls and the insides carried the loads of the building. At that time, this kind of technology had not been really implemented before. We achieved this also with the help of a number of very wonderful French engineers who helped us in the structural engineering of this work. But in any case, while there was this technological contribution, I became very concerned, because what I was doing was I was building a home in a way that would not necessarily accommodate an Iranian way of life, because here we were building the first apartment towers, and the apartment per se, without a garden, without a courtyard, without the sense of individual privacy that more or less the courtyard house had provided before, and the association with nature. Ultimately, I felt that the building of such towers was not culturally appropriate, nor environmentally appropriate to Iran. When the buildings were actually completed in the 1970s, my theoretical studies had been almost complete. I had already finished my manuscript for The Sense of Unity. I had taken 2 years of journeys with my students at Tehran University to a number of the places, such as Shushtar, where we stayed a week and we drew all the systems of waterworks that had been carried out in the Sasanian period, and we even drew how the subterranean houses with their cooling towers had been designed, and the courtyard houses of Kashan and others had been drawn and used. By that time, I was philosophically, theoretically, ready with a new package of ideas about adaptive environmental design and culturally relevant design. So while Saman was hailed as a great success because it brought new images into Tehran, my own mind was already seeking a expression of what my theoretical work had evolved. Two things helped there. In fact, three things. One was that we were designing at that time the Asian Games for the World Asian Games to be held in Tehran.
What year was that?
Well, actually, it was the first of that. The Asian Games were already held in 1972, but the 100,000 seat stadium was completed in 1970, and so my work on that began really in the 1968, 69, And I remember vividly anticipating the idea of placemaking. This was an idea that had not been very much nurtured in my professional work before. What does it mean to make a place? And this idea of makan, of a place, of a unique place, sense of place. So I won't describe what we did, for instance, with the Asian Games in great detail, other than to say that there was a absolute barren, hot, arid, alluvial plain with a valley called Khargush Dare running through it, with a trickle of water that would run in this Khargush Dare.
It
was between Tehran and Karaj. It was to the west of Tehran. And what started there started from, I guess, my first awakenings. Since my first awakenings were in the areas of Khuzestan, where we had our first ziggurats in Chilozambil and the use of earth and mud earth, that project has a very strong, I would say, pre-Islamic influence in its work, because its imagery and its metaphors were all dealing with the ziggurat, with the great mound idea. But its placemaking ideas had to do with the idea of paradise garden, which is again a very Achaemenid idea that we know historically through the recordings that have been made. So what we essentially did was we took 4 million cubic yards of earth from this valley and mounded earth, compacted it at one end to create the slope for this seating of 100,000 people. And at the same time, this compaction created an earthen dam, and so we flooded this valley, and it became a natural reservoir of water. This natural reservoir of water was then used to pump and irrigate 165 hectares of landscaped area, within which was then set all the playing fields and the other sports facilities. And so today, when you go to the 100,000-seat stadium environment, it's a total microclimatic change. You have created an entirely vegetated environment with water, water recreation, and the idea of this earthen stadium. Of course, the stadium was then followed by other covered arenas, but already the theme and the idea that was in my mind was beginning on Aryamer Stadium, as it was called, and I guess it's now, I do not know what it's called today. That theme was the theme of the great mound building of earth structures of the Elamite and early Achaemenid constructions.
Do you see, that's interesting, because the sense of unity has more to do with the whole idea of Zahir and Batin, manifest and latent, manifest and hidden, whereas this one seems to predate that idea. Is there any relations between this whole idea of mounting, and is there an idea of unity there too? Is there relations to...
Oh, I think so. I think that, theories take a time to gel, to become crystallized. When any architectural project takes years to conceive and to build. So some theories that you have only begun to blossom, and they're not fully yet clear in your own mind. So you're using those pieces that have been enunciated. In this one, actually, when you see the stadium from the outside, you see a very plain mound which is surfaced in brick and concrete. Then you see several great gateways into it. As you penetrate through this gateway, however, you suddenly are inside an incredible interior. So I think that the idea of Zohar and Batin are here, but it is not in this building, it's not in these buildings that this idea was made fully manifest. It was really made manifest and realized, I think, first in what was called the Iran Center for Management Studies. In 1970, my friend from childhood, Habib Lajavardi, had a great idea, and that was to try to bring a Harvard Business School, where he had attended and had graduated, to Iran. This was also very much supported by the various businessmen of Iran and the ministry of the ministries related in Iran to try to develop at a higher level the management skills of Iranian management. A land was chosen in the Vanak, again a very dry, treeless site. And the idea was that a school of management should be designed here. There were a number of proposals immediately given by the board of directors about what the image of this should be. One wanted it to be a tower, a Western image tower. And others said that it should be just like Harvard University. I listened to all of these. And
the architects were making
these were really the board of directors, members of the board of directors, who were businessmen. I then visited the Graduate School of Design and the Business School in 1970. I met with the professors who were going to come to Iran to carry out this work, and I actually went to all their classes, and I found that, first of all, there were several unique ideas that characterized the Harvard Business School. It was based on a group of six students working together, or eight students working together as a basic unit, and then it would go into a discussion group. Maybe it would be 16 people, and then it would go to be something like 50 people. There were case methods, and so really the process of their study was something that I absorbed. When I went back to Iran, we developed an idea for the design that was, however, uniquely out of the image of Iran as I had carried out in my work. One was, again, this idea of placemaking, and a important image was the Bagh Fin in Kashan. Here, 19th century garden, but which recapitulates gardens that had been in Iran for 2,000 years. And the idea was to create a school in which the walls would be living walls. That is, you would have the dormitories where the students would live on the perimeter, and at the center you would have the library, and around the center and the walls would be the great garden, and then at the gateway would be the administration, and at the other end of the wall would be the classrooms.
Was your book published by then?
The book manuscript was ready. The book had not yet been published. The book doesn't get published really until 1972 and 1973.
But it was in conjunction with...
But it was definitely in conjunction with that. Mm. And the sense of unity, which was the book that was published by the University of Chicago, had a subtitle, and the subtitle is The Sufi Tradition in Persian Architecture. I struggled an enormous amount with the subtitle. Finally, I met one day a fellow professor who said to me, why do you bother with the subtitle? Why don't you just call it The Sense of Unity? I said, well, because...
The Persian or American?
No, no, it was an American. And he said, why do you bother with a subtitle? Why don't you just call it A Sense of Unity and the people will find out what it is when they open the book? I said, no, I want the title to be a gateway, to have an indication of the special emphasis of the view. And that special emphasis that in these 3 to 4 years of research that I was glimpsing, even when I wrote The Sense of Unity, and I, by the way, in this work, I was aided and assisted by Laleh Bakhtiar, who I asked to co-author this work with me. The reason for it was that she was also investigating the history of Islamic philosophy at Tehran University. And she had great interest in the bibliographical and academic understanding of this subject. The Sense of Unity also owes, I think, a tremendous debt of gratitude to the guidance that Sayyid Hossein Nasr gave to its evolution. And, of course, it owes a lot of debt to many architects who were my mentors, who never knew that they were instrumental. But, you see, in the late 60s, one of the great architects in the world was a man called Louis Kahn. Lou Kahn lived and worked all over the world. He lived in Philadelphia. He was one of the great teachers at the University of Pennsylvania. This individual had an idea about architecture which dealt with the measurable and the unmeasurable. And he did a series of beautiful buildings in Ahmedabad in India, and later on in Dhaka in Bangladesh, and also in the United States. Many of these that I visited, in Iran later on, we were to work with one another. Before his death in 1973, we were to spend at least a year trying to do some projects in the Shahistan-e Pahlavi, in the center part of Tehran. In any case, Kahn's idea of the measurable and the unmeasurable triggered in my mind to look for the unmeasurable in Persian architecture. And the reason why Kahn was looking for the unmeasurable was that he was very deeply influenced by Egyptian architecture, which also has this unmeasurable or mystical dimension in much of its ancient buildings. In fact, Kahn very much admonished that I would visit Luxor and other Egyptian monuments. And in fact, it was very, very strange that the year, the day that I and my family were to go to Luxor to visit the Temple of Luxor and the Valiant Kings of the Queens that he had directed that I would go to visit, when we landed there, we read a newspaper of Kahn's death. So there was a tremendous synchronicity involved with these guidance that you get from friends and associates.
But he said he didn't want you to go there?
No, he wanted me to go there. He said that, I think that for you to understand some of the things that you're struggling with, both in Persian architecture and in philosophically what I'm dealing with, I think that you ought to journey to Egypt, because there is also a ancient world which has many mysteries in its way of bringing architecture into being, symbolically. So this is a way of saying that the sense of unity dealt with the idea of the Sufi tradition in Persian architecture, because I found that when you wanted to deal with architecture, you had to go into who was producing the architecture. The architecture was produced by craftsmen. When you went to find who these craftsmen were, such as masons or carpenters or plasterers or mosaic faience layers and makers, you would find that these people were very much involved in craft guilds, and that craft guilds had a master, and that there was a master-apprentice relationship, which went all the way back to ancient times, of the discipline of the master being both a spiritual master as well as a master of the trade. I want to say that in time, as I journeyed to other parts of the world, for instance to Pakistan. In Pakistan, in the early 80s, I was commissioned to do a series of hotels for the Aga Khan. When I went to Faisalabad, I sought again to find what were the traditional crafts of this area. And I was told that the traditional crafts were plaster work and mirror work in plaster. I asked to be shown the master of that guild. When I went to see that master, his name was, for instance, Sheikh Mahi. He was exactly the prototype Sheikh, a spiritual master as well as a master of the trade. In fact, when I was interviewed by him, and when I interviewed him, it was at the footstep of his mausoleum that his apprentices were building out of love for him. And in time, in a few short years, Sheikh Mahi died, and he's buried in this environment. When I journeyed to Morocco, to Marrakesh, to Fez, I also came across exactly the same phenomena. When one now studies most of the ancient traditions of the world, whether it is in Japan, or it is in India, or it is in Iran, or Egypt, you come across that the idea of the craft guilds and the master of the craft guilds have an enormous amount to do with how the architecture came into being. So therefore, these esoteric traditions, which had been secret traditions, which had been sine bis sine, which had been breast to breast, were beginning to, of course, die in the onslaught of the contemporary world. But still, at the time that I was in Iran, and I was operating as a young professor at Tehran University, and I was moving from one place to the other, I was able to experience people who had this kind of background.
Were you able to find any of such masters?
The interesting thing about Iran is that in Iran, we as a group of people are already so spiritual that in comparison to much of the rest of the world, already we live every day of our life in this very cosmic way. I mean, just think about Nowruz and other relationships that you have with it. And by the way, the mystical Sufi tradition that I address has definite pre-existing, pre-Islamic context. This is a tradition of a way of looking at life. So if one were to look at it, such a tradition goes all the way back to what is called the Hermetic tradition. It goes back to Hermes Trismegistus. It goes back to ancient Egyptian work. At the same time, very much the same things we have been finding go back to very ancient mystical dimension of the Zoroastrian faith. My work was not to study religion. My work was to study the impetus to art and to the creative process. That is really what I went after. That's why the sense of unity is organized the way it is. It first begins by concept of existence, and then it goes into concept of space and concept of shape and concept of surface and color and material. I think that book was like a roadmap about how to design within a more indigenous pattern, something that perhaps later on now, when we go and we now look back in retrospect, the revolution in 1979, etc., people were also maybe you thinking about such things related to other facets of life. For us, this kind of theoretical revolution, when I say us, because there was a handful of young people who were involved with this. There were some of my students at Tehran University. Some of these students came and joined me when I set up my company called the Mandala Collaborative, Shirkat Mandala, in Tehran in 1972. And we carried out very methodical, coincident professional and theoretical work trying to extend this vocabulary and grammar of traditional Persian architecture. Therefore, you see, the Iran Center for Management Studies was the first test case, really, of a full-blown theory. And the interesting point about it is that it was reviewed as a success the day it was opened by the King and Queen of Iran. And at the same time, after the revolution, it's one of the key theological centers in Tehran, still being very popular with a new regime. So there must be something sui generis, there must be something universal about what is being done in these theoretical base and in that placemaking and that architecture that can appeal to both very Western-oriented mind of an Iranian, as well as a very, fundamental orthodox mindset. At the same time, I must say to you, many of the Westerners who came and lived and taught at the school loved it as well. So I would like to say that possibly we are touching on certain themes which are sui generis to humanity. And of course, since Iran is such an ancient land, I'm sure that there are in Iran the residue of a lot of primary architectural placemaking ideas which are just generically accepted by humanity, such as the idea of the Paradise Garden. In any case.
But may I just say that it seems that actually your book and your work were somewhat prophetic in the sense that what you just were seeing as an architect, as an artist, was later on to be transferred into people's discontent with their processing their place where they were living. I mean, it seems to me that what you talked about, this thing being sui generis, and the whole idea of Khan and placemaking, because people were upset about.
I think so.
And really, I mean, now that I am listening to you, it sounds to me that it was prophetic.
I'm sure that prophetic has not very much to do with it, but I think as it was so blatantly evident in the 1970s, and now we go, to the other cycle. We went from the mid-60s to the, 73, where Iran had a certain income and a certain amount of, therefore a certain amount of possibilities that it could build. From 1973, Iran suddenly had this windfall income, and the amount that it was going to build was enormous. So consequently, the amount of mistakes that we could make was also enormous. That's where you're right. That's when this thing started to really show itself. Most of the models that had been brought back to Iran by people who meant, I think, very well, whether they were educated in France, in Germany, in England, or in the United States, or in Italy, because that's really the five sort of countries in which Iranians had gone out to study. But since we had 100,000 Iranians studying in the United States versus, you know, much less in the other countries, the impact of the United States in the 70s became much more rampant. What I think immediately started to happen is that these people brought back models of progress, of so-called progress, and the models of so-called progress had very little to do with both the philosophic, cultural dimension or the environmental limits of Iran. I remember people complaining to me that in the houses that I did, I was still designing courtyard houses with closed walls. They said, why don't you tear the wall down, open the garden out to the street so that people could benefit from the landscape onto the streets. Now, this was a classic statement about doing a house in Boston or in Chestnut Hill with a completely different ecology, completely different way of living and life, because the house there exists as an isolated object with grass and lawn all around. The Iranian house was just the opposite. The garden was on the inside and the house was all around, because we aimed for privacy, and this idea of Zahir Batin was very important to us. So people were not understanding the philosophic base of their culture that they were throwing out, and they were trying to espouse other shapes and ideas of living without, I think, fully digesting what was happening. So I do believe that a lot of what we went through in the late 70s was the wrong environment buildings, both in the individual unit of house or place of work, as well as the wrong environment of city.
Do you think some of these mistakes that were made have to do with the fact that there was this tremendous increase in the ability to buy things or to do things? I mean, this money that came in. Do you think if that money hadn't come in, we have been more cautious in making plans or implementing?
Of course, of course. I'm sure we would have been. You see, we went through a situation where there was a lot of wealth and the wealth had to be consumed. So we took all the ready images and it was just like buying a Sony radio. So you bought a Western house. If we had had less income, I'm sure that we couldn't have afforded that Western house.
We're conserving.
But at the same time, if we had had more models available that were that received the seal of approval, so-called, that were both indigenous to our culture and to our climate, then I think people would have been using those. And actually, some of that happened. When the Iran Center for Management Study was built, it was built using this buff brick in Ajur Gulbehi. That up to that time, this was viewed as the common man, the poor man's brick, and it was not very elegant. Suddenly, after this building was built and it received such high praise, Ajur Gulbehi became the standard for a lot of people because it carried with it the symbol that it was used in a very prestigious building, and so it means that this was a sign of arrival of a good place.
Well, why do you think such models, such more indigenously inspired models, did not become as dominant as progressive?
That's a very good question. I'm sure that you have to interview and speak and do a particular research on that. In the article I wrote for the Encyclopedia Iranica, I give a context of what I thought might be a brief answer to that. I'll give you a summary. I think that really, just before World War II and following World War II up to the 60s, the School of Architecture at Tehran University was the premier place in which Iranian architects were trained. Well, how did the School of Architecture there get started? It was set up by a very gifted man, Henri Godard, who later built, of course, the very nice Museum of Archaeology in Tehran. And Henri Godard students such as Dr. Mohsen Furuti, for whom I hold a lot of high regard, but he and Dr. Hushang Sehun, and later on others such as Qiyai and of course even Aziz Hamayan, all were Ecole des Beaux-Arts graduates. The Ecole des Beaux-Arts in the 1930s and 40s was essentially producing an architectural idea, which was the idea of the objet, of the object. The idea of the isolated, beautiful object, which are manifested most significantly by, for instance, the great monuments that both Furuti and Sehun built to the great men of Iran, you know, such as Wali Sina Monument in Hamadan, or Hafez tomb, etc., or the classic idea of the object in space. True that in a certain way, in the Achaemenid and Sasanian periods, we were building some objects in space, but definitely from the Islamic conquest of the 7th century on, we reduced the concept of object building, and we were making much more something what is called a seamless garment. That is, everything molded into one another. So if you were to fly over Esfahan, you would understand the seamless garment. It is one great brick with some holes punched into it, the holes being the courtyards, which were the lungs of the city or the lungs of the house. This idea of the seamless garment, of the what is another theory that was written about in the sense of unity, is called positive space theory. It's a very interesting idea. It's picked up today by the most leading architects, even of the United States of the world, for instance, I.M. Tay and other people, use this theory called space positive architecture. They take it right from the sense of unity, they acknowledge it, and they talk about it as coming out of Iran. This idea of what we're speaking about, of a undifferentiated, a continuous pattern of a social fabric without objects suddenly being made the main elements, such as you find, for instance, in Paris, you know, you find the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, etc., these objects in space. Iranian architecture in the last 1400 years has been very, very much removed from that way of architecture building. But the contemporary architecture that came principally from the Ecole des Beaux-Arts to Iran through Tehran University was object-oriented buildings and Ecole des Beaux-Arts influence. Yes, they did take their students to study, but they came back with motifs. So they would build, for instance, the great buildings that were done for many of the bank buildings, or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, or the Ministry of War, you know, has the Persepolis stairs and the lion eating the bull, etc. These were all just symbols or objects being taken. They weren't studying the philosophy of the placemaking or the social idea of the building. I think, in fact, one of the great lack of attention of the Ecole des Beaux-Arts school was twofold. One, it had no social content, and second, I think it had no ecological understanding. So they just took motifs. So they would take the head of a bull from the column in Persepolis, and it would become an objet, an object in space. And we're not an object in space. That's against Zahir Batin. Zahir Batin, the Zahir is very, very plain, has only a gateway that says something lies between you and I, it's inside there, and it lies hidden for you to discover it. Whenever you make an object, the object shows itself, and there is no inside. So this was one of the one of the shortcomings of our education in Iran. The Tehran University was then transformed in the late 60s. Groups from Italy, who had been educated in Italy, who'd been educated in the United Kingdom and America to a small extent, penetrated and replaced the French speaking and French educated background. I would say Tehran University principally stayed in that melange of three cultures, with some indication mainly to the Italian way, for 10-15 years. Menli University was the other school of architecture. Again, that had not such a Ecole des Beaux-Arts precursor. It almost went directly Italian. And again, the school that you had there from that period of time had a very interesting social content. So there was social understanding. But at the same time, there was a very leftist thrust. So they were not at all interested in looking at the indigenous Iranian concept of Zahir Batin, because that had a religious implication, and they were anti-religious. So now comes some key elements of, I think, that are interesting professionally. How then this group of architects working in Iran with the various government agencies interacted. In 1970, the first International Congress of Architects was held in Esfahan. A group of us promoted that this would come into being. I, by that time, was very anxious to have some place to present the sense of unity research. Some of my other friends at Tehran University were very much interested in other aspects that they felt had been totally neglected. And so we produced a invitation through the Ministry of Housing and Construction, and I believe maybe 50 of the top world rank architects were invited, Lou Kahn being one of them, Buckminster Fuller, Paul Rudolph, and many names, you know, came.
Was this government-sponsored?
Government-sponsored, but essentially, I would say, four or five young Iranian architects structured this discussion.
So you have to submit the plan to the government in order to get permission to
Well, they were very interested.
This is through plan organization?
No, this was through the Ministry of Housing and Construction. The Ministry of Housing and Construction was very eager to help support these kinds of, because they wanted to have some immediate, any government body wants to have an immediately tangible product, and a conference is an immediately tangible product. At the same time, they were interested in bringing in world figures because that would bring attention to Iran, and we were very interested because we thought we would gain ammunition, we would gain support. If we only demonstrated to these people what was in our minds, then we would gain support, and in that way legitimize what we thought was a more sane way, rather than this absurd aping of Western patterns. So. In Esfahan, a wonderful series of conferences occurred. Exactly that kind of confirmation did occur. The Queen inaugurated the session. She felt very touched by what she was hearing. And I think that because she had already a background into architectural education, she immediately could sense that there was something of value here. And so I felt that from that period of time on, she was very much a supportive figure in the resurgence of a new Iranian identity in architecture. Definitely she was a person that in many other venues and other domains later on supported the idea of a integration of indigenous Iranian architecture. And you know, she was trying to do it in her own way, by the clothes that she would wear, etc. Now, whether that was successful or not successful, I'm not going to talk about that. But in architecture, I felt that there was a person that could be even considered a patron to this movement.
But what is it? I mean, it's interesting that despite her support, and of course that became quite evident, you know, I remember her wearing the indigenous dresses and all that, but despite her support in the realm of architect, apparently that line of thinking didn't become as dominant as the one that was thinking still about the progress and modernization and high-rise building.
Oh, yeah, of course, because that had to do with media. The movies that you went to and the magazines that you saw were all coming out from the West. So, you know, in comparison, this was a 5% impact versus 95% impact, but it was 5%. It was better than nothing. Yeah. So in 1970, this was held, and of course, that's the point. Although we'd hoped for a tremendous effect, the effect was marginal, because architecture is marginal. Architects are marginal in the overall thrust of a society and the images and the policies. But in any case, marginal as an impact. Mm. I mean, you know, classically it has been documented by the great Greek planner Daxiotis that only about 4% of a country's buildings are done by architects, and 94% are done by other ways, you know, by private means, non-architects, using the simple, construction that exists. And of course those people were highly motivated to try to become suddenly very Western and very much, you see, there was the equation of progress with Westernization. And this was what our conferences were trying to deal with. Philosophically, we were trying to say that progress was spiritual progress. Progress was social progress. Progress was not a GNP progress. And this was, of course, by some members of government viewed as, in fact, they were very anti this kind of view. Now, in 1973 and 4, I was commissioned